behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott Benjamin.
And I am Ben Bullen, comrade.
I wasn't expecting that, but yeah, you're right. My comrade Ben and I will be discussing Iron Curtain cars today. Mm-hmm. That is via email suggestion from one of our listeners. His name is Harold. And Harold wrote in to say, hi, Scott and Ben, I enjoy your podcast.
Thanks,
I enjoy the historical shows the best, like the history of the Volkswagen or the history of the Bentley. My suggestion is a podcast on the history of Iron Curtain cars, like the Trabant, the Skoda, the Lada, or the Yugo.
Mm-hmm.
But again, he likes the historical angle on these the most. So I think we're going to cover a lot of, and don't let this frighten you away, there's a lot of history in here. However, I want to point out that it's not so much we're going to cover the politics and you know, what all that involves, but more so how the politics kind of shaped the Russian auto industry and how the people of Russia adapted to that.
And later, the ways in which that pre-existing relationship also shaped cars in Yugoslavia, in East Germany, parts of the USSR.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, he mentioned a few of the models here that we'll touch on these.
Yeah.
We'll mention the Trabant and the Skoda and the Lada and the Yugo.
We'll also mention the Moskvich, the Volga, the Zaporozhets. I mispronounced that one.
We are going to have trouble with some pronunciations, as you may have already guessed. So be prepared to laugh at a few of those as we go through here. But, man, there is a rich automotive history in Russia that I didn't know about, because most of it is pre-World War II or World War I.
Right. Yeah, it's true. A lot of Westerners may not be aware about the history of the very first cars made in Russia, which, Scott, do you have a...
Well, the date. I mean, if you want to go all the way back, which we like to do, it goes all the way back to 1896. Now, they've had cars in Russia since 1896. I never, ever, ever would have guessed that.
Yeah.
Because what we think of now, what we commonly think of here in America, I mean, this is probably the wrong way to think about this. I mean, if we really dig into the history, we'll find, like I said, a rich history of automotive fascination there or manufacturing. I tend to think of extremely stripped down, bare bones, you know, no frills cars that are very plain in design, get the job done. You know, they make it through these Siberian winters and they're very strong.
They're utilitarian.
Very utilitarian, very little style.
Mm-hmm.
As far as compared to every other car around the world, as we'll find out.
Right.
But that's what I tend to think of. Now, you know, we had a couple of examples that have been imported here to the United States, and that's probably where we get most of our ideas of what the design is like. And, you know, we've seen documentaries and we've seen, news footage of the regions, you know, like maybe in Moscow, you'll see the type of cars that are driving around there. Nowadays, I mean, now in, you know, 2013, we find that they're going through this nouveau riche era where, you know, there's a lot of very expensive, very, very high-end.
Exotic, flashy supercars.
A lot of exotic cars, a lot of luxury vehicles. A lot of people are really kind of going completely the other end of the spectrum on this thing. So you know, take what we say here today, understanding that, you know, it started out with this very rich history. It's kind of, in modern day, it's back to having a rich history, but it's more so imports than anything else at this point, as we'll find out.
Yes.
There are still some modern manufacturers that make some fantastic products that we'll tell you about.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, there's this era that's kind of a bleak era in Russian car design, and that's what we're gonna talk about here, because I think that's what Harold was getting at.
Yeah, when he says behind the Iron Curtain, I think he's meaning Russia. He's also meaning the post World War II division. Now we're just going to really quickly, fast forward up through some important dates to World War II.
Well, and also he says Iron Curtain, and I think we need to mention that is a very specific time in Russian history, and it ends around 1991. Now it goes from 1917, I guess, or 1920, up to about 19, 1991. That's when the fall of the Soviet Union happens.
Yeah.
So let's get into it, and you'll understand what we mean. But you know, after the curtain came down, I guess is when they did begin to advance relatively quickly.
Right. Yes. And there are a couple of reasons here. Now, as we said, we are not my comrade and I are making this podcast for the people. Right? For the proletariat. So
we're I don't know if I can keep up with your jokes, Ben. I'll try.
Maybe one of them will be funny at some point in the podcast.
We're going to have to use some Yakov Smirnoff jokes in this, maybe.
We should.
Yeah, yeah. He's funny. I was watching some clips of him early, just before we came in here, as a matter of fact. He was at Dangerfield, I think, in the like 1980s. And hilarious. Good stuff.
He just doesn't get enough credit.
It was good stuff. His beer commercials even are funny.
Yeah, we should wait. Who is he, real quick, to catch everybody up?
Oh, he's a Soviet Russian comedian, a stand-up comic. He did television, he did movies, he was in beer commercials, like I said. But honestly, I was just watching him 10 minutes prior to this, and very, very funny stuff.
And one of his most memorable lines is always the transposition of "in Soviet Russia."
In
Soviet. You do it.
No, like in America, you drive car. In Soviet Russia, car drives you.
Yeah. And
that kind of thing.
He's been super well known for that. He's a brilliant comedian. There are also some brilliant engineers historically in Russia.
Yeah, that's right. And we need to get back to the story now. So with our side note aside there, I guess.
Prior to
1917. So let's go back prior to 1917. And this is the economy of the Russian Empire. It was deeply embedded into the European economy at the time. So there was this real free exchange of ideas. And, you know, that's when you see these really grand automobiles coming out of Russia. Look at any car prior to 1917, from like 1896 all the way up to 1917. And the Russian car designs, really, really nice. And when I say surprisingly nice, I mean compared to what we did see in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, you know, that era that we'll talk about later. But some really great designs coming out of there. Now, they had a revolution, the revolution of 1917, and that kind of paved the way for the formation of what we called the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, or the USSR.
Mm-hmm.
And that existed, like I mentioned earlier, from 1922 till about 1991 when the Iron Curtain fell, really.
Mm-hmm.
So this whole Cold War era, you know, a lot of us here in the States will think about Reagan, you know, saying,
sure,
tear down that wall, you know, that speech. But, yeah, so they did have, you know, really nice cars prior to 1922, but you know, at the point when they became the USSR, now they wanted these mass-produced, kind of Soviet industrialist-type cars, mm-hmm, that you know, everything had to go through the government, everything had to be approved through agencies before.
From the top down.
From the top down, and it became very, very restrictive, and there was this atmosphere of isolation.
Sure.
Throughout the whole country.
And this is a very interesting historical question here, because one of the strangest things about this period in time is that we see some of the world's most amazing innovations coming out of the USSR. First man who successfully went to space and came back, mm-hmm, you know? That's amazing. He survived space.
It's incredible.
But for some reason, a lot of the car industry lagged. Now, we've talked about this before when we go international, Scott. One of the reasons that so many other countries import cars is because it's actually devilishly difficult to build a domestic car industry from scratch. There's, mm-hmm, so many other pieces you need to make this puzzle.
Yeah, that's right. And they've always kind of been a little bit on the backside of this curve, in that They had a great big car factory that we'll talk about in the 60s that I do want to get to. And that still, I think even to today, produces automobiles. And they're finally getting to the point where they're producing maybe more cars than they import. But that's not always been the case. And again, there's just so little trade going on. Now, remember, there's this, well, it's communism. There's communism that's happening there.
Mm-hmm.
It creates this atmosphere that's really isolated. There's very little or no trade at all. That's going, you know, into or out of Russia.
It's a great point. I'm glad you made it.
And I just need to say that there was a lot of corruption as well. There's just I'll call it abundant corruption.
Yes,
because that's what it was. It really became that way in that automobiles and any kind of implement like that became not toys of, but rather just something that was given to government diplomats and anybody that was involved with the government agencies. It was something that wasn't reserved for the everyday man.
Whoa, comrade. All cars are equal. Some cars are more equal than others. But no, that is a good point. Because in some cases, what we found here in our research is that, you would have to, if you were a typical citizen, you would have to have some sort of permission in order to buy a car. So imagine if you would, you know, whether you're living in the United Kingdom now or Canada, the U.S., or Russia, imagine if you had the money to buy a car, right? And you knew which car you wanted.
Sure.
But before you could buy it, you had to specifically ask a governmental authority for the green light to buy this vehicle.
Yeah, sure. I like that new Lada model that they're making there. I saw it on the lot, and I think I want to buy that. Well, you need to write a letter to the agency or the Department of Motor Vehicles or whoever it is there. I'm not sure what the name of the agency would be, and request that you can buy an automobile. And they may say that, no, I'm sorry, that's on backlog, and you're not going to be able to purchase one for three or four years.
Or you may have to know someone who can help you jump that line.
Yeah.
Or there might be a nominal administrative fee that suddenly pops up.
This becomes like a government-sanctioned black market almost in some ways.
Yeah, it's like a gray market. But before we dive right into the different models of cars, which we should, I wanted to go over and highlight again some of the driving points that stifled automobile innovation during this time.
Sure.
Now, you already hit on a lot of them, but let's just make sure that we get this out here. Trade was difficult.
It was difficult, not impossible.
It was difficult, not impossible. And sometimes this was not the USSR's fault. There were also sanctions, trade sanctions placed upon the USSR for various materials and for various reasons.
Well, sure. The United States is saying that under communist rule, we're not going to allow our vehicles to be imported into your country, and we're not going to trade back and forth with you. We're just not going to play nice.
Right. And on the other side could be equally antagonistic.
Exactly.
So it's important to remember that when we're talking about this stuff, we're not saying that it's any one country's fault specifically when it comes to the trade sanctions. Yeah. We're just saying they affected the cars.
Here at Car Stuff, we're going to point fingers at either country and say who was right, who was wrong in this case. How about that? Let's just talk about the cars and leave it at that.
Well, okay, but later we should pick like one obscure country and then just pick on them for no reason and see if we get letters. Okay, never mind.
Yeah. Kazakhstan, that's you. No, I'm just kidding. No, we're not going to do that.
Watch out, buddy.
No, anyhow,
the other thing is that the way in which free enterprise or private industry, quote unquote, was handled in this economy made it a little bit more difficult for some, you know, Joe Bright Idea schmo walking down the street to get struck with that burst of innovative lightning and then go out and make the next, you know, the next Ford or something.
That's true. Yeah. Now, we're talking about free trade of ideas and, you know, being able to bring in engineers who can kind of bounce ideas off of each other.
Sure. Secure some sort of capital.
Exactly. No, these were, I'm sure that they were coming up with some of these designs in, pretty much a closed off area in their own, I don't know how better to say this. Isolation, really. That's what it was.
Mm-hmm.
Other than being able to, and a lot of times they mimicked some designs that they were able to find. Mm-hmm. So I want to talk about that later because there's some very clear-cut examples of mimicked car designs that I can point to. And I can tell you where to go to look at these, listeners. So there's somewhere you're going to be able to find these. I do want to point out, though, that in 1929, because here in the United States, we were having a really difficult time economically, right? And it's just prior to the big crash, the period, the Depression throughout the 1930s, I guess, and just having a very, very tough time selling some of our domestic cars here. So, you know, like the Fords and Chevrolets just weren't flying off the lots.
Right.
They did import a lot of these to the USSR at that time because sales at home were so poor. Model A's actually were put into production in Russia during this time. Now, they were called the Soviet Fords, and some of these were adapted, of course, to suit these severe, Russian winters and the road conditions, because they're much more poor conditions there as far as road conditions go. And can you imagine what a Siberian winter is like on a 1929 Ford? It's got to be rough. I mean, I know they're built well, but
it's got to be rough to start it.
Yeah, these Soviet Fords were built under the brand name GAZ, G-A-Z.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'll find a lot of these Soviet Fords that still kind of hanging around because, you know, they were built very, very well. So they were all the way into the 1930s, they were built but with no licensing agreements. The Soviet engineers would sometimes copy the designs.
So just reverse engineered.
Yeah, so they would look at, like, say a Buick that came in.
Mm-hmm.
And just one example, in the 1930s, they took a Buick 90L, and they used that to create the first Soviet limousines for the Communist Party executives. They made about six cars, and they were the ZIS-101 model, ZIS-101.
Mm-hmm.
And they're pretty much a copy of the Buick engine design and the Cadillac body.
Mm-hmm.
So they're very opulent, but they're definitely not for anybody. They're not for everyone. They're just strictly for the government officials and you know, these Communist Party executives.
Right. Yeah.
So, man, I mean, it's just like we can go through and we can count all. And that's kind of the beginning of this era where all the designs. And I think I should just share with the people right now what we've got because
yeah.
I found a site called Real USSR. And it was posted on, this was posted in 2009 by Dmitry Yakmenko. And, it shows very clearly the outright copying of designs from like the Ford Model A, the Buick 90L that I just mentioned, the Ford V8 models that we talked about in the Bonnie and Clyde episode.
Yep, that's 34.
They take, like the Packard design from the 1950s, the Ford mainline. I mean, there's a Russian counterpart, for each of these designs that looks almost identical. Ben.
And is it always several years after the first production of the U.S. model.
That's a good point.
So the Packard 180, 1942, and then the ZIS 110.
Which is a direct copy.
Emerges in 1946.
So, yeah, there's a five-year delay there. And so 5 or 10 years behind is what the Soviet design happens to be. And they didn't always keep up. I mean, it wasn't always like, you know, because here in the States we had, and elsewhere, I mean, let's French or, you know, whether it's a French design, whether it's
right.
an Italian design, German design, whatever. You know, they're all building cars like, you know, like all over the place. There's manufacturing happening everywhere. The Soviet Russia design, it just lags behind 5 or 10 years. And whatever design they happen to get their hands on and then copy or like you said, what do you say?
Reverse engineer.
That's right. So they were able to tear it down and kind of see what makes it work. So like I'm looking at a French Simca from 1975. And in 1986, they came out with the Moscovich 241, which is almost an exact copy of that.
Yeah, and according to this list that you gave me, they also – I have a copy of the list that you gave me, which is very nice. They also did the same thing with Nissan. So even cars as far away as Japan – or you know what? I apologize to anyone else who just – caught my egregious mistake there. Japan is super close to Russia, actually.
Yeah, very close.
So,
very, very close.
So I don't know why I was thinking with the typical American American centeredness there.
That's
but,
okay.
But this, what's amazing about this is, given the point about how difficult it can be to create a domestic car industry, and then to create one in fairly stifling economic isolation at times. I think it's important for me to get this out before we talk about some of these cars, which are less than perfect. Scott, I was so impressed, and many of these cars weren't that well known in the West at all. I mean, they're still maybe not that well known, but they weren't very known in the West before the fall of the wall.
Mm-hmm. Sure. You just didn't get to see them. We didn't have an opportunity to see what was there.
So I was thinking we could dive in and maybe talk about probably the most well-known, the equivalent of the Honda Civic or whatever.
Let's do it.
The Trabant, right?
Sure.
Okay, so the Trabant was the, let's see, it was built of Duroplast.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard of this?
I think I have, but enlighten me.
Its body was built of this combination of cotton, paper, plastic, and wool. Its engine was 26 horsepower, and it was a two-stroke. So you had, you know, of course, mix the oil with the gas. And it should be mentioned that a lot of people who are car enthusiasts don't have very many kind words for the Trabant. They have said some things like Trabant smoked like an Iraqi oil fire when they ran at all and lacked the most basic of amenities like brake lights or turn signals. Reminds me a little bit of the Tata Nano.
Can you believe this? It's, I mean, we're talking about a car that was produced. The one I'm looking at is a 1975 model.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking at.
No brake lights, no turn signals.
None.
It's hard to believe. And an 18-horsepower two-stroke engine is powering this thing.
Yeah, and it was already kind of a is already kind of outdated when it was originally designed in the 50s.
Yeah, yeah. So there's definitely some lag time on the design and the engineering ideas that are behind these things.
Right. So a lot of people think that it was just underpowered and a disappointing vehicle overall. However, this is a really quick sidebar. It's so interesting though. You remember John Steinbeck, right?
I do.
Wrote Grapes of Wrath?
Yes.
So Grapes of Wrath is a story about a family of from Oklahoma, or typically called Okies, right? Mm-hmm. And during the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl, they migrate out to California in hopes of a job.
Mm-hmm. And difficult journey.
Enormously difficult journey. And they've got this old jalopy, and there are scenes in Grapes of Wrath wherein they have to deal with dishonest people who are, abusing these downtrodden folks.
Sure.
John Steinbeck writes this because he wants to humanize the Okies because a lot of people are just being horrible to them.
Mm-hmm.
And a film is made of this, and it was shown in the communist era, the USSR, with the idea of, I guess, some sort of propaganda purpose or something, but it backfired.
Well, showing the plight of the poor Americans, is that what you're saying?
Or something like that. Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And exactly. And it backfired when it was shown because people would watch this and say, wow, no matter how poor you are in America, you can still own a car.
Oh, I see. So that became the focus of what they were.
The focus was the car because people love, we got to think like people love cars. The Gaz is not that bad. The Lada Niva has even been called a halfway decent SUV.
Oh, you know what? I want to talk about that Lada Niva because in a moment, when we get back to kind of the, as we're rushing through this history here kind of quick. That was made at a place called the Togliatti plant, I think.
Oh, this is the big factory, right?
Yeah, the big factory. And I know I'm kind of skipping ahead here, but man, there's so much to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
But the Togliatti plant, it was this really big factory that was built in the late 1960s, and it was a big deal in Russia because this is really the closest they came in that time period to a modern European level manufacturing facility. And it was a big privilege for people to be able to work there. The people that built the factory were the people that worked in the factory as well.
Mm-hmm.
So they had this real hands-on feeling for, what happened, to build that plant, then to make what comes out of that plant. And, that became a real source of pride for them.
Talking about from the ground up.
National pride. That's right. But this Lada car, I mean, that's the all-wheel drive vehicle, right?
Yeah. And it,
the Niva, I guess.
Niva. Yeah. Yes. Thank you. And, some people would call it the Russian Range Rover.
Mm-hmm.
Now it was, pretty rugged and, well, in comparison, And this actually got kind of popular in Canada.
Yeah,
it grew an export market.
After 1991, I think, is when it started to be exported. And I think they built this thing up until fairly recently. If not, they're still building it. I just don't even...
I have 1998.
Okay, yeah.
It's when the sales ended.
Okay, got it. But it was... Boy... 1977, I think, is when the Niva started production. But it was really, really rugged. I mean, this is the one that you'll see. It's a four-wheel drive vehicle. I mean, it'll be on places, you know, this terrain where there's no roads at all, mm-hmm. Climbing very steep inclines through heavy snow. I mean, it's really, you know, it's made to put up with the best of the weather, or the worst of the weather, rather, that Russia could throw at it.
Yeah.
And it did become an important export car for them because, you know, I think that car went everywhere. I mean, they started exporting it to, I think Japan mm-hmm. is one area that it exported to. Canada was one that you mentioned. I don't know if it ever came to the United States, but we have had a couple of cars here in the United States from Russia.
Yeah.
At least one that I think everybody can think of immediately, which is the Yugo,
mm-hmm.
Which even now you're smiling and thinking about it. I know, I can tell.
Well, but, okay. Before we go on to the Yugo, which okay. we should, I do want to read a little piece of some Lada marketing
that we found.
Mm-hmm. Made for Siberia, not suburbia.
And, that makes perfect sense when you see it. I mean, it's very
yeah.
utilitarian, like we said, but it gets the job done. Surprisingly, Ben,
yeah.
these cars, now, and this brings this up,
mm-hmm.
these cars that are made, I mean, they're very, very stripped down, like I said, very bare bones. I mean, when you look at them, you're not going to find a whole lot of, you know, aesthetics to them. They are really built to last. I mean, they really do. They're built to go through, as I mentioned, these really tough road conditions,
mm-hmm.
Siberian winters. I mean, it doesn't get much more harsh than that on the planet Earth, really.
Right.
It really, really is a well-built car in that sense, in that they last a long time. You can go out and expect it to start up in the morning.
That is true.
And very few moving parts. That's the other thing.
Now, you just hit the nail on the head.
Now, they're not fancy. But
no.
they've got very few moving parts. And I know it's funny to say this, but maintenance on them is relatively easy.
Which makes them more reliable, actually.
Or it used to be relatively
well,
easy.
Well, okay, that's true. Because now in modern day, a lot of these vehicles are no longer made, so you'll have to go aftermarket, right, to get
yeah.
parts.
Oh, yeah.
To get maintenance. The conversions might be a little tough for some people.
Have you ever seen the used car parts markets that they have set up for these Russian cars?
Oh, yeah. You can find photos of them online.
Pretty amazing stuff. I mean, yeah. really. I mean, they've got a little bit of everything, you know, kind of hanging in bags on pegboard all mm-hmm. around and, you know, propped up wherever. But I know that if you have a Russian export car that, you know, you're they're still, to this day, difficult to get parts for even modern Russian cars in that they just don't make enough of them to have extra parts laying around. I mean, they don't provide enough extra parts for the spare part market. Easy for me to say, right? But so a lot of these things, and if you've got an older car, you have to make parts, which kind of brings us back to the days of the Cuban cars. Remember those?
Right. Yeah, we've got a great episode on why Cuba has so many classic cars and how amazing their mechanics are.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say that by the time Trabant production stopped, oh, and Trabant was an East Germany car.
Mm-hmm.
By the time the Trabant production stopped, they had made over 3 million.
3 million. That's a pretty big number.
3 million. Well, this is from 57 to 91.
Yeah.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
And now there are Trabant car clubs all over the world. People like this car, man. It's
yeah.
got remember that movie Rudy? It's got heart.
It's got a little cult following, maybe.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
And
especially when you consider the maintenance
now,
is so low.
I have seen there's kind of a funny thing that I need to mention here. The Top Gear did an episode, I think, with what they called commie cars.
Oh yes,
and
yes.
And if you search for this, it's pretty funny. In that, you know, it has this this group of individuals that get together, and they've got these kind of, I don't know, it's an eclectic batch of cars, but it's a little bit of everything that was produced in the USSR at the area that we would think about. You know, these a car like the Velorex, which is actually which is vinyl strapped over this really flimsy metal frame.
Mm-hmm.
the guy driving it said it felt like driving a wet backpack. It was flexing so much, and it was a bad car. Then there's these Soviet Zills, which are like knockoff Packards.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a car that, oh my gosh, this Chica. Chica is, I think I say it. Chika.
Oh yeah.
It's a huge, it's a 5.5 liter V8 engine car, and it looks like anything from the United States out of the 1950s.
Right. Yeah. And it's one for the historically was one for the more connected Soviet officials.
But however, this car was built until, like, you know, almost 1980, It was built late into the 1970s. So, you know, again, it's like, that's like 20 years behind. But it does look like anything out of the late 1950s, like a late 50s Packard is what it looks like, really. It's almost a direct copy of that.
Yeah.
But there's some fantastic cars in that small episode. It's very short. It's kind of funny. It's real tongue in cheek, but it does tell you about how, you know, parts for these things are almost impossible to find. You have to manufacture things, or you have to modify things in order to make them work. It's concise. It's well put together. It's very short. It's easy to watch. So
it's worth your time.
Yeah, again, Top Gear. It's an older piece, so you know, be ready for that. People that aren't even around anymore on the on that show. So
I kind of want to talk about my favorite of the Iron Curtain cars.
What's your favorite?
Okay, it's fairly predictable. Do you want to guess? I bet you can guess.
I don't know. I'm not a Trabant.
Oh man,
a lot of Niva.
Oh, you wound me, Scott. I thought we knew each other better than that. It's the Tatra T603.
Actually, I did know it. I just didn't want to give it away.
Oh, okay.
But that one has a little style, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's got what the young kids are calling swag.
It does. It's a good-looking car.
It is also a fairly good car built in Czechoslovakia, former Czechoslovakia time. This was sort of the creme de la creme of the automobile industry in that area. They had a rear engine, but there were some that I think had front engine, but mostly they had rear engines, and the big names of the USSR's friends and family had this, including Fidel Castro.
No kidding. You know what? I love the front end of that car.
I think it's
really cool. Now, it's like, it's classy in a 1960 way.
Yes.
I mean, I got to point that out. It's not anything modern.
No.
However, I really do think that one is kind of a standout in as far as design goes. Now, I do like the big limousines, the Packard, you know, knockoffs.
Right.
But I really think for, you know, that type of car, I think that model that you mentioned, the Tatra looks, was it 603? Is that the one?
Yeah, T603. Yeah.
That car, I think it's just got something that makes it stand out from the rest. And if you look at it with, you know, a group of other cars, you'll be able to pick it out in a minute.
Exactly. Yeah, it's got much smoother lines. Mm-hmm. It's not, the form factor is completely different. Now that we've mentioned my favorite car, I want to avoid going down a rabbit hole on that, because I could talk about the Tatra for a while.
Yeah.
But we're doing podcasts on multiple cars. Let's talk about, let's bring back the Yugo. Scott, do you know why it's often called the worst car in history?
You know what?
Do you have a guess? Does it deserve that reputation?
I think I could probably come up with 100 reasons why it would be called that, but what's the main reason?
Well,
is there a main reason? Maybe that's the better way to put it.
You know what? That might be the main reason.
Now, one thing that did surprise me about this. Now, it was built, and I don't even mean to cut you off, but
no, you're fine.
It was built for over 4 decades in Russia. Now, here in the United States, we only saw this car from 1986, or maybe 1985, I think, is a model year, through 1991. Mm-hmm. So it was imported to North America for just something like 5 years, Ben.
Yeah.
But it was built for 4 decades in Russia.
It was at the Zastava plant as well.
That's how long this thing kind of hung on, but it had a lot of issues. I mean, there were some major quality issues that were the problem with this thing, as far as I know. I've never driven one myself. I can actually tell you where I drive by one every day.
Oh,
every single day I drive by a Yugo. I don't know what year, or I'm sure it's a Yugo GV model.
Is it being used, or
is it just
camping?
It's parked in a parking lot of a collision shop that I pass on my way home every day.
Oh, no.
And there's a handwritten note on the windshield of this thing.
What's it
say? I don't know. It's so far away that I haven't driven in to actually look at it. I'm going to have to do that. But it's written in, you know, like when people would write on a car window if it's for sale.
Right, yeah, and like the soapy letters.
Yeah, exactly, with the soapy letters or whatever it is. I think it's like, shoe polish or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's got some type of note written on it, like don't laugh if whatever, you know, something. It's like a slogan. So maybe they take this around to shows or something. I don't know what they do with it. But I do pass a Yugo every single day, so I see one regularly. I got to tell you, even at the time, back in the 80s, late 80s, 1990s, mm-hmm. I wasn't ever tempted to buy one of these.
Yeah, I don't know anybody personally who's owned a Yugo. I get the feeling that in the Soviet climate, it was one of the most easily available cars,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think that some of the gripes, at least in the West, about safety may be exaggerated.
Well, because we were accustomed to, I mean, we were probably decades ahead of them already at that point in safety advancements and design and comforts, creature comforts. Because, I mean, when you look at the marketing for this car, I mean, I think they listed, what did they say? It was carpet was listed as a luxury in this car. It was listed as an add-on.
Yeah.
So, you know, you didn't get everything with this car. You didn't get, you know, the detail and the molding on the doors and everything. It was very, again, utilitarian.
Right. And that's part of, you know, to make a larger point here, I think that's part of the philosophy difference, philosophical difference between the car makers in behind the Iron Curtain at the time and outside of it. Mm-hmm. There were cars being built as sort of marks of individuality, high performance, mm-hmm. more show-offy, you know, mm-hmm. in the West. And in the Eastern Europe at the time, that is not quite as much of a motivating factor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, also...
Well, it was just a super bare bones car. I mean, by all accounts.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
And the cost, it was like, I think brand new car, it was like $4,000 maybe or less. It was less than four. And, even at the time, that was a really low price. So, you know, it was an affordable option for, you know, someone going away to college, something like that. However, I think a lot of parents thought, you know, I don't really want to put my kid into something like this, you know, after they investigated a little more, because, you know, it just didn't seem like it had all the safety features that we're accustomed to here. It didn't have all the creature comforts that, you know, someone might be, or someone might require, I guess, on the road. You know, mm-hmm. I say require in finger quotes because you don't really require all of that. You just need it. You feel like you need it.
You just like it.
You just like it. That's maybe the better way to say it. But by the late 1990s, I guess the facility that built the Yugos was damaged by, bombing. As a mm-hmm. matter of fact. So, I think that kind of put a sort of a temporary halt to production. That's maybe why they quit being imported here. I don't know for sure that's a fact, but, later they were advertised as a Fiat built car. There was some type of, tie-in with, the Italian company Fiat.
Mm-hmm.
And, I guess it didn't help it a whole lot because the last Yugo was eventually run off the line in about 2008.
Mm-hmm.
So all the way up until 2008, they were building the Yugo, even though we kind of had it off of our radar here from 1991 on.
Yes, and that's one of the things that I think is important for us to note, to go back to the Trabant there so we don't get in trouble with listeners. The Trabant was on a U2 album cover.
Hmm.
And it was also in tour there.
Very important.
On tour with U2. Yes, it is very important for us to mention that, Scott. Let us not be remiss. I have something that might be a little bit of a positive point for us, and that is that Eastern European cars are becoming hot on the classic car market.
Really?
Yeah, well, think about it, man. They're kind of unique. They're probably going to be a little bit more affordable than, say, an Aston Martin.
Oh, I would think so.
Yeah. I hedged that pretty hard.
Sure.
But, you know, we mentioned they've got that cult status.
Absolutely.
And if you want a classic car and you can find one of these, then it's kind of a rarity.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and I think that they're out there because, I mean, the production numbers were, believe it or not, there's enough that they're still out there.
There were so many, like the Lada Rivera?
Yeah,
Lada Riva.
Now, they may have been tough to get your hands on at the time, but now, I mean, you're able to find them, you know, used car lots, you know, here and there, import, export, you know, however you find these types of things.
Mm-hmm.
They are bringing a lot of new cars into Russia, and there's people that make a pretty good living doing that, importing cars. I watched a short documentary on some guys that do that. They get these visas, go over into Japan, import cars back into Russia, sell them for profit. You know, they look for certain makes and models. And, and Russia is one of these odd places where they drive on the right, I believe. However, they do allow cars that have the steering wheel on the right, where most countries that allow, that have that,
yeah.
they require the steering wheel be on the left. So if you're driving on the right, your steering wheel is required to be on the left. But Russia is one of these countries, very few of these around that do this, but allow driving on either side. And that's, Not primarily, but in some ways, because there's some pushback from these guys that make their living doing this and that they import cars.
Oh, I see.
And that's how they make their living.
And probably with the popularity of importation in general, there are a lot of people who are buying cars with the steering wheel configured that way. I've got a number for us. 20 million, a little bit less than 20 million Lada Rivas. And those were based on the Fiat 124.
Now, I'd say that there are probably many, many of those 20 million cars left behind. So if you're looking for, you know, a low-dollar Russian car, that's probably one you could easily pick up or find anywhere on a used car lot somewhere.
I just love the photos of these, too, because I know that for a lot of people, aesthetically, this is not a pleasing thing. Like, one of the largest complaints is that they look boxy or something like that. But it's so neat because it's a living piece of history, if you can keep it running.
True. And you know what? There are other options, I guess, because there are also U.S. cars that have been assembled in Russia, which is kind of strange. They're called complete knockdown kits, or CKDs. Mm-hmm. And there are these factories almost that are set up that operate this way. They import cars from, let's say, Chevrolet here in the United States, or Ford or Chrysler, whoever. The cars arrive in pieces, almost like a kit car, really. Mm-hmm. Only they're larger components, and they're just the final assembly happens in Russia, and then they're sold in that market as a new car. And I think they do some of these as well as, you know, from other countries as well, not just the United States. But these complete knockdown kits are something that's kind of unusual. And if you look it up, you'll be able to find some more info about that. And they also have been for modern cars, because there are some really pretty decent modern cars coming out of Russia.
Absolutely.
There's some sports cars that I think some people are probably wanting us to mention. there's the I'm going to pronounce this maybe right, Marussia? Marussia? Mm-hmm. It's Marussia, Marussia. And they make a couple of supercars, really. They make one called the B1, the B2, and then the F2, which is really kind of like a sport. Sport utility vehicle, I guess. But these are really high-end vehicles. I mean, we're talking like supercar-looking vehicles. Something you would completely not expect from what we've seen in the past out of Russia.
And supercar prices, I imagine.
Exactly, yeah. And there's another car called the Ego Revolt, which is kind of a funny name, I guess, for a Russian car, the Ego Revolt. That's based on a Mitsubishi platform car. Some pretty amazing limousines are still coming out of there. The Zill models, I guess. Those are still not for everybody, but, there's a lot happening right now in the Russia economy that's kind of deciding which way they're going with the cars right now. And I mentioned this Nouveau Riche, era that's happening there.
Right, people, oligarchical era.
Yeah, and everybody is starting to import cars and they're upping their game, I guess. You see a lot of Land Rovers, a lot of BMWs, Mercedes. Mm-hmm. You'll see a lot of different export cars that are considered high-end cars anywhere in the world, really. And you're going to find them on Russian roads.
And I think that we should do a whole different podcast about driving on Russian roads. Have you been watching those Russian dash cams
Definitely.
On YouTube?
Oh, there's so many of those.
There's so many. I want to do, before we get out of here, I want to do an honorable mention of some cars that we didn't get to.
Oh, man. One quick thing.
Yeah, go for
it. I just want to point out there's so much. I think we've got gaps in our history here, but and I don't want to go back and read them, but I know that we've skipped over some stuff. There's just too much to include in this episode.
This is a big topic.
So, please mention some of the cars that we didn't mention, because there's a laundry list of automobiles that come out of Russia during this time period that we're just never going to be able to get to unless we focus on that one car.
Right, exactly. So we mentioned the Moskvich 408, I think. Mm-hmm. Did we? 50 horsepower. I'm just going to read the list. I'm sorry. I don't want to fall in a rabbit hole.
Fair enough.
The Volga Gaz 24. I think we did mention that. The Zaz 968, or the Zaporozhets, which I mentioned at the top. This is one that Vladimir Putin owned.
Very nice.
And then we mentioned the Lada Niva. Mm-hmm. The Polsky Fiat 126P. This had big numbers, right? Eventually over 3 million were made. The Wartburg, which we probably would have gotten trouble for not mentioning. This is interesting because East Germany made it, to maybe sell to Western Europeans as well.
Okay. So the Wartburg made in East Germany. I don't know if that sounds like a car that I'd, initially be attracted to.
Having Wart in the name is a little bit tricky.
Wartburg, East German car. Okay.
Let's see. We mentioned the Skoda, I think.
I think we did.
Okay. And, the Balkan Yugos. We mentioned those.
Yeah, all of these. You can find photos. I mean, Ben's mentioning a bunch of different cars. If you look at these photos, you're going to find, like we said, you know, the pre-1917 stuff, which is gorgeous in design, and then some of the mimic designs that go through, you know, the 1920s, 30s, all the way through, well, the 1950s, really.
Yeah.
And then they kind of have their own style from the 1960s, 1970s. And it's that almost, if you look at a Yugo, it's almost like that. Just think of a lot of different versions of that for some of them. And mm-hmm. then, boy, then there's standouts like the Trabant that you mentioned, the 603.
Yeah.
And I don't know, some of the Zill limousines that we talked about, and the Packard knockoffs, those that were still being produced into the 1970s and 1980.
Right.
I mean, those are some standouts, I guess. There's some real standouts in Russian car design. And I think if you just look up Russian cars, you know, just do searches for all this stuff. I mean, look up the list on Real Russia.
Call in sick to work.
Yeah, exactly.
Do this instead.
There's so many different ways to look at this, and all the import cars and cars that are coming out of there today, and the history of manufacturing there. It's just, it's a very rich history. And I say rich in that, you know, prior to 1917, there was that amazing era, and then there's this kind of like darker period, I guess, where it was the Iron Curtain.
And there's
cars.
Vibrant manufacturing base in Russia now, and this manufacturing base, like, when you think about it, it's something that I guess a lot of people lose sight of, but there is enormous potential to create or to grow the existing car industry there. And I think that right now I am so into foreign made cars that most Americans might not know about. Remember, we talked about Muammar Gaddafi's Libyan rocket.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to do some more podcasts on these things.
Some just amazing one-offs, I guess, maybe?
Yeah, amazing cars that you might not have heard of in the West. You know,
it's a great idea.
If somebody could give us some suggestions for that, we would love to hear from it. Scott, do you have anything else you want to
make? No, I've lost focus so many times during this because I feel like we skipped around in time. But I do think we got, you know, the message out that, you know, there were these dramatically different periods of design in Russian cars. And look into each one because they all have their own, their own style, their own eccentricities, I guess.
Their own unique appeal.
Exactly. Their own unique appeal. And even to today, I mean, if you look at Russian cars today, modern cars, I mean, they've got their own style and their own zest. I don't know how better to say it. That's probably the worst way to say it. But
je ne sais quoi.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
So we are going to leave it at that. We're going to head out. We're sorry that we couldn't get to all the cars, all the stories we wanted to tell, but we hope that you did enjoy this look at cars from behind the Iron Curtain.
Yeah. Harold, one more thing.
Yeah.
Harold, if you want a specific vehicle highlighted, like maybe the Yugo or something like that, write back, please, because we got tied up in the history thing, and I know you like that. I hope that it did the job.
Yes. And you can find us and tell us how we did on Facebook. Be nice. let us know what you think on Twitter. If you have any ideas, anecdotes, personal experiences with one of these cars, or if you'd like to suggest a topic for an upcoming episode, please do send us an email. We are
carstuff@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.